Caregivers, have you ever felt like nothing? I mean, nothing is going right? Well, cheer up and welcome to Dave the Caregiver's Caregiver Radio Program, where you'll learn how to avoid that dreaded thing called caregiver burnout and how to survive the grief process. You know, with roughly 100 million caregivers in the U.S. and Canada alone, that's about a third of the population. That means that everyone probably knows someone caring for a loved one. Join Dave and his guests now and every Wednesday at noon Pacific time as they discuss avoiding caregiver burnout and surviving grief. So find a comfortable place to relax, kick up your feet, and prepare to feel better and to receive practical tips and tools that you can start using immediately to get you through today and every day so you can survive your tomorrows. But not just survive, but to live life fully and abundantly. Yes, you heard me right. That is a possible goal to achieve. And now, here's your host, Dave Nassani. And from Los Angeles, a big LA welcome to all my listeners out there in Radio Land. I'm Dave, the Caregiver's Caregiver, coming to you live globally through the worldwide Blog Talk Radio Network, as well as many other platforms, including iTunes and YouTube, etc. I guess we can also say it's coming from New York City, Manhattan, and it's coming from Virginia, because that's where our guests are coming from. And our goal here is to do our very best to help you avoid that dreaded thing called caregiver burnout. And we have a very exciting show planned for you today with my lovely co-host, Adrian Gruberg, founder of the Caregiver Space. Say hello, Adrian.
Hello, Adrian.
Say goodnight, Grace.
After all these weeks, I have to.
Well, today, we will be interviewing caregiver advocate, blogger, and trained caregiver support group leader, author Bobby Carducci. Did I pronounce that right? Carducci or is it Carducci?
Either one will work, but my husband and I usually use the Carducci pronunciation.
Carducci. Yeah, that sounds like Italiano, huh?
Definitely. Not I, but my husband Michael. In fact, he did the ancestry DNA test and found out he's more Italian than the Italians.
Yeah, that's possible. Anyway, stay tuned. You do not want to miss this show. That's just a tiny little sample of the fun we're going to have. And I am your host, Dave Nassani, and this show is Caregivers of Every Single Kind. And the one thing we know about caregivers is that they are caring and selfless and sacrificial. And they have this tiny little problem, just a tiny little problem. They're very prone to burnout. Actually, it's a giant problem because they tend to put everyone else's needs above their own. And we can learn something from the airlines, should I say, including United, because they tell us in the event of an emergency, put your own oxygen mask on first before you attempt to help your loved one with their mask. And why do they tell us to do that very selfish thing? Sounds like the most selfish thing a parent can do, right? But, you know, there's a good reason. When the plane is going down and all hell is breaking loose and your child is gasping for breath, you want to put your mask on first so that you'll be around to help them. And caregivers are the same way. We don't want them to black out, and they should put their needs above the needs of their loved ones, or they won't be of any good to anybody, anything. Mm-hmm. Now, we also talk about grief and loss here. Every time we suffer a loss, we go through the grief process. And let's face it, we're all losing something every day. I lost my keys just yesterday, you know, and I was grieving the loss of that, but I found them, and then I was happy again. But most losses are much greater than me losing my keys. Some people lose their girlfriend. Some people lose their spouse. Some people lose their health. Doesn't matter what it is. We go through a grief process. It could take days. It could take weeks or months or years to get through it. Everyone is different. And unfortunately, folks, there's only one way out of the grief process. You got to go through it. There's no shortcuts. Can't go around it. Got to go through it. So hopefully we can help you through your loss and your grief if you feel like you're stuck. And speaking of caregivers and books, I'm so excited that our long-awaited third book is getting closer and closer and closer to becoming reality. We'll let you all know when you can begin the pre-purchase process. It's called It's Life, My Life Too, When to Say Yes and When to Say No, and Reclaiming Your Caregiver Sanity. Caregiver sanity is pretty important, I think. We're believing that by pre-selling 10,000 books to our caregiver followers, that we could qualify for possibly the New York Times bestselling list. And even if we don't, We're going to help a lot of people. So thank you for your support in all of this. And enough of that. And a very big welcome to Adrian and to Bobby. Welcome to the show, Bobby. And thanks so much for agreeing to this interview today. I'm so excited to have you on.
I'm excited to be here again. And thank you for inviting me. I'm looking forward to it.
And I know Adrian's excited too. So why don't you take a minute or two and just introduce yourself. I like to ask my guests, just who is Bobby Carducci and why was she put on this earth, God's green earth?
Oh, why was I put here? Probably to learn a lot of very valuable lessons, things that I probably should have known coming in here, but didn't. I guess my initial training as a caregiver came from being a mother of four, and now I was the grandmother of eight. But I began my caregiving lifestyle when taking care of my father-in-law, Roger, when he came to live with us after his wife passed away. And I was his caregiver for 7 years. And he was an interesting character. And he had multiple illnesses in addition to dementia. He had schizophrenia and Parkinson's disease and with that severe swallowing problems. But probably what made his particular case more interesting was he had stubborn old Italian disease, which I thought particularly challenging. He said to me one day, "You realize women in the old country are second-class citizens, don't you?" And I said, "Well, you realize you don't live there anymore, right? You're in my house now." So that kind of took him back a little bit. But he was an amazing character. Before he became ill, he spoke seven languages. He had advanced degrees in mathematics and literature. He was hunted by the Gestapo in Italy when they took over his family farm at the age of 17. He was an absolutely amazing man, and it was my privilege to take care of him when he wasn't able to, for most of the rest of his life, to remember some of those things. As challenging as it was to be a caregiver for somebody whose innate intelligence was greater than my own, I see it as a gift, and it definitely changed the direction of my writing in the direction of where I wanted to be going forward, and that is as a caregiver, supporter, and advocate, because I think it's so important for caregivers to know that people like us are out there for them and working for them and recognizing what they do every day.
What kind of dementia did he have? I mean, was he mean? Was he submissive? I mean, there's so many different symptoms that dementia takes on. Did his personality change? I mean, what do you know about that?
It depended on the day. For most of his life, primarily, I think, because of the schizophrenia, he was extremely introverted and felt very uncomfortable with people. So we made sure that we made a spot in our home where he could be alone if he wanted to. He had a sitting room with a television and a sofa and a recliner chair, so he could be there if he wanted to in his own bedroom, in his own bathroom. And sometimes he wanted to be with us and sometimes he didn't. When he did want to be with us, I made sure to sit and listen to what he had to say. But as his illnesses progressed, he could be quite aggressive. There were a couple of times when he scared me a little bit, but he never actually got physically involved with either one of us, but he would kind of push the envelope a little bit from time to time. I didn't know it at the time. It wasn't until after he had actually passed away and I was reading some of his medical records when I saw the term Lewy body dementia.
Yeah, we had a guest on talking about that. That's very interesting. So did you ever have to put him in a facility, or did he die at home? Or
he died at home. We were lucky in that because of the diagnosis of schizophrenia that came while he was serving in the military in 1947, he was granted a 100% service-related disability, which meant that it paid for almost all of his care, all of his medications, and he could have gone into a VA hospital nursing home at any time. Mm-hmm. However,
are there any good ones? Or are they all, you know, not so good?
That I can't speak to. I can speak to the care that he got as an outpatient, which was very good at the time. But because of the way that he behaved when he was in the hospital or under doctor's care, we knew it would be very bad for him to be admitted to a full-time facility because his tendency was to hide any symptoms that he had and tell the medical people, go take care of the sick people, I'm okay. And when you have a system that's already overburdened and you have a patient that says, I'm okay, he would end up just completely getting worse and worse and worse. And we knew that it would be quite fatal for him to be there. And I was fortunate enough to be able to leave my corporate job, and my husband supported us, and I could be with him 24/7.
You know, common questions about dementia is that you mentioned there was some times that you were scared, you know, maybe he scared you or something. How do you know when it's time to put your loved one in a facility when you start feeling scared or things are unpredictable? Can you comment on that?
If you are physically in danger, even once, I think it's time to really consider that. And one of the things that I tell people when I'm talking to them about being a caregiver is do not ever say, I'll never put you in a facility. Because you may not, be able to keep that promise. There may come a time too dangerous for either one of you. And
what should they promise instead?
I'll see to it that you get the best possible care. I will still be there for you. I will still advocate for you. I love you. I have to make sure you get the best possible care. And it's tough to make that, be strong enough to make that decision. But I've tried to make that very clear with my own children who used to say, I'll never put you in a home. And I've told them, put the addition on the house, I'm coming.
Yeah, I can't tell you. I'm sure Adrian has the same statistics. There's so many people who are just killing themselves because they made that promise. Or their loved one made them make that promise to you.
And the thing is, if it makes them feel comfortable in the moment for you to say that, as long as you understand in your own mind, in your own heart, what the promise really is making sure that I'm going to make the tough choices and I'm going to see to it that you get the best possible care.
Yeah, because chances are they won't remember that you made that promise anyway.
Correct.
And in the event that they do make the promise, how do you get out of, when you already made the promise, how do you get out of it and kind of pivot to that other promise you said?
I would blame it on the doctors. The doctor said this
good
is...
Good cop,
this,
bad cop.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
That's great. And then likewise, was he ever driving? Did you ever have any issues or taking the car keys away in the beginning?
I did not, because he had been so ill for so long. He had and took a great deal of medication. He hadn't been driving long before he came to live with us. However, he did insist to me on a number of occasions that he still had his driver's license and he was an excellent driver. But
that's what Rain Man said. I'm an excellent driver.
Exactly. It reminded me right away. The driver's license had expired more than 30 years before that, but he still carried it. Yes.
Wow. Yeah. You know, my mother-in-law, my mother died of dementia a couple of years ago, and it was a good death because she wanted to go, she was ready to go, and it went quickly. But my mother-in-law has also come down with dementia, although it's been not diagnosed because she can outsmart the doctors. You know, they give her that test where, you know, you count backwards by sevens. She can do it. She can answer the questions. And, you know, she has a very good memory. But 5 minutes from now, she won't remember talking to you. And I had a very frustrating conversation with her just yesterday. She's telling me that someone's coming in the house in the middle of the night because they're leaving dishes in the sink. And she always puts the dishes away. So there's got to be someone coming in. She's changed the locks 3 times, and her son told her, we are not changing the locks again. Do you know how much it costs to change the locks? So I says, you know, is it possible that that no, I says, maybe you started sleepwalking. No, that's not, you know, just, she'd rather believe that somebody is coming inside the house and somehow they have a key and this and that. So it's so frustrating.
Well, maybe you could say to disease. Maybe you could say to her that whoever is coming in the house is very hungry, and isn't it nice that they found a place as pleasant as hers? And because if we try to use logic, if we try to tell them, you know, that this just isn't happening, you're not going to convince them.
Yeah. You know, she has a doggy door, and cats come in now, and they're peeing on the rug and this and that. And I says, well, maybe the cats are pulling things down off of it. I see some pretty amazing videos on YouTube of what cats can do. And
can she, do. You know,
she wouldn't buy that either.
That's kind of, but that's very creative. Yeah, I like that kind of creative thinking when it comes to. Yeah.
Any ideas, Adrian?
No, I'm listening. It's a great conversation. I'm sorry, I'm not contributing.
That's okay. Just speak up if something comes up on your mind.
I've just been very blessed that I have never had anyone that I've cared for with dementia. Yes. Except for Steve for 3 weeks before he passed.
Only 3 weeks?
Yeah.
Very fortunate. Was it a really bad 3 weeks?
Oh, it was interesting.
Well, we should have you on the show sometime. We'll talk about that.
Well, life is never dull when you're a caregiver. I can tell you now.
That is so true. Now, you call yourself a caregiver advocate. What the heck is a caregiver advocate to someone who's just, I mean, I didn't even know what a caregiver was when I became a caregiver. They told me I was a caregiver. And I says, really? What's a caregiver? So there might be some people out there who don't know what caregiver advocates are and what you do to support caregivers.
Well, I call myself a caregiver advocate because I live my life and I schedule what I'm doing around the needs of caregivers, whether it's writing the second book in the series or writing about my experiences and interacting with people on the blog and the caregiver support group that I now lead in my local community. It's so important for caregivers to know that somebody out here understands how difficult it is what you're doing and appreciates how hard it is, and give them a place where they can come and vent, feel free to express their emotions that sometimes we think are negative, but are part of being human in this process. People used to say to me, "You must be a saint," and that really bothered me. And my response was always, "I am no saint," and he'd be the first one to agree with me. You are not saintly when you do this. You feel all of those emotions of anger and sometimes resentment because your life has been changed and you're exhausted and you are putting the needs of others in front of yours, and you don't feel very saintly in the moment. And I kind of live to let people know it's okay to feel that way. And if you need to vent, you can vent here. This is a safe place for you to be as human as you absolutely are.
You know, we deal with a lot of caregivers online, but I actually went to my first event where we had about 50 caregivers in the room. And I was a little surprised at how caregivers look, because they just look like normal people. And many
Why
of them.
Why shouldn't they?
Well, but my point is, many of them look like they're too old to be caregivers. They look like they're in worse shape. You know, and it looks like they should be in the hospital. And I'm just looking at the audience saying, oh my gosh, what sacrifice these people are giving, you know, without looking at their own situation. I mean, they look like they need caregivers, and they're out there caring for all these people. Have you found that? Did you go through a little shock when you had your first event and saw some of the people who showed up?
Well, one of the things that shocked some people that I'm acquainted with was when I posted a picture of myself towards the end of my caregiving. And You know, my hair was falling out. You know, of course, you had no makeup on. You were exhausted. And I've had some people say, boy, you were really brave to let people see what you look like at that time. And when you're going through it, you don't really realize the physical impact that it can be having on you. I had a nephew who I hadn't seen for a few months. And when he saw me, he said, oh, my God, Bobby, you got younger. So, which was a nice thing to hear, but, and the truth of the matter is some of these caregivers are really too old to be caregiving. I work with one regularly who is in her 70s. Her mother is 92 and she's in her 70s. And you wouldn't think that you would be having to care for somebody at this level when you are that age.
Sure, it takes so much out of you, and especially, you know, for a 70-year-old, they should be enjoying life and going on cruises and stuff, not, you know, sentenced to caregiver prison.
I mean, I don't believe that my father would ever have said he was a caregiver, but he took care of my mother for years. He was 83 when he died. He was sicker than she was. And yet he was the best, one of the very, very, very best caregivers I've ever known. He put her first all the time.
So he was just doing what he did for the last 50 years, just taking care of his wife.
Yeah, he did.
No and, change.
And she had, chronic pulmonary disorder, and there were lots of things that he had to do that were very physical. And when I was with them and when I would visit, he would have retreated to a chair in the kitchen and just fold his arms and put his head down so he could rest a little, because it was his way of taking a much needed break. And he could only do that because I was there. Some patients are certainly more difficult than others, and my mother was a particularly difficult patient. And he died first.
Yeah. Well, let's take a break. It's a good time to take a break, and we'll be right back, so don't go away.
One Arm, One Leg, 100 Words, Overcoming Unbelievable Hardships, is about Charlene, a stroke survivor. Back in 1996, Charlene was a healthy, normal, very active 52-year-old woman whose amazing talents resemble that of both a Martha Stewart and a Wonder Woman. But all that changed when she suffered a massive stroke that left her severely speech impaired and paralyzed on the right side. Who am I? My name is David. I've had the privilege of being Charlene's husband since 1975. We had a wonderful, fairy tale, storybook-like courtship that culminated in our marriage a year later. Charlene had just come out of a marriage where, after 10 years, she received two black eyes and a broken nose by her former husband when he came home high on speed. Charlene believed in no second chances of any kind for abuse, so she left. Finding herself all alone in the world with her 5 and 10-year-old daughters, Cynthia Lorraine and Deborah Lynn, she started raising them by herself for the next 2 years. Then fate brought us all together. After falling in love with Charlene, Cindy, and Debbie, our love then produced Rebecca Elizabeth. We had a wonderful, normal life for the next 20 years. But today, things are very different for everyone. One Arm, One Leg, 100 Words, Overcoming Unbelievable Hardships, is the amazing story of a woman's fight to survive all that life had thrown her way. Everyone who knows Charlene is thoroughly amazed at how she lives day by day, month by month, year by year, and with a smile on her face and hope in her heart that everything is going to be okay. Her faith in God is her foundation in this hope, that everything happens for a reason, and what doesn't kill her will make her stronger. She inspires everyone who meets her. Her accomplishments since her stroke are very impressive, often making us normal people look like whiners and complainers. So pick up your copy of One Arm, One Leg, 100 Words, Overcoming Unbelievable Hardships today. You won't be disappointed. Just hear what best-selling author Lynn Barrington has to say about it. If you think you have it bad, read this book. This is a beautiful, genuine story told from the heart. It's inspiring and easy to read. When you finish this book, you'll be able to look at your concerns in a new light. How about the reaction of 9-time Grammy and Dove Award recipient, the godfather of contemporary gospel Christian music, Andre Crouch? Charlene just won't let the promises of God go, and she has not let her circumstances get in the way of her faith. She's not just a survivor, she's more than a conqueror, as the Bible states. You'll be encouraged by her testimony, regardless of what you're going through. Available everywhere, but if you purchase your copy directly from the author's website, onearmoneleg100words.com, Charlene and David will personally autograph your copy. Enjoy!
And we're back with Bobby Carducci and Adrian Gruberg. And Adrian looks like she's
stepped away.
So you mentioned in a presentation you developed called Prepare to Care, What Adult Christian Children Need to Know About Alzheimer's and Dementia Before and After It Strikes Home. That sounds like some valuable information. What kind of information is included in your presentation?
Well, first of all, I don't know how the word Christian got in there. What adult children?
Say Christian?
Yeah.
What did I say?
You said adult Christian children?
No, that applies adult children. If I said that, I read it wrong.
I go to as many caregiver conferences as I can fit into my schedule in the Washington, D.C. area. And I was at one not too long ago, well, maybe about a year and a half ago, and one of the speakers said, you should be bringing your children to these events. And I thought, they're absolutely right.
How old are they? Just adults?
Well, yes. And
teenagers,
anyway,
no?
I've actually done presentations at high schools based on this, but I specifically geared it toward people in their 30s and 40s whose parents are moving into this age where you know, dementia is really striking and striking hard. And I asked my daughter, Kelly, she and her friends all turned 40 in the last year. And I asked her if they would be interested in receiving information on dementia and Alzheimer's. And she said, absolutely. A parent of one of her friends had already been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. So I developed the presentation to run for about an hour, and it covers things like what is normal aging versus something more serious that you need to be concerned about, what you can do to prepare now, what to do then, with examples about certain behaviors and how to respond to it, and where to go for help. So she invited a number of her peers to come and hear this first presentation based on this, and they were so interested in asking so many questions and so involved in learning about this that I actually was there for over 2 hours responding to this group of younger adults who are very interested in this. And that convinced me that this was something that was valuable in reaching out to a demographic that isn't necessarily considering this at this time. And when I started talking to people about it at caregiver conferences and giving them my card and making this available to them, the interest just seemed to grow and grow. And it's not only just in the Alzheimer's dementia world, but ALS organizations are interested in this presentation, Easter SEALs, law enforcement. I happened to do a presentation on this, and one of the members of the Rotary group that I was speaking to happened to be a major in the sheriff's office, and I saw him nodding in agreement as I was speaking. And so afterwards, I went and I introduced myself and I spoke to him, and he mentioned where some of their concerns are. People with dementia and Alzheimer's are younger in many cases than they ever have been before. And when they wander, they're getting further and further away. So I asked if he would be interested in my coming to speak with the men in the sheriff's office. And he said, absolutely. And one of the things I talk to them about is sometimes the caregiver doesn't know how to respond and inadvertently escalates the situation and how they can calm those things. So I'm very excited about the outreach to law enforcement, because I know of two instances. One was personal to our situation, and another with one of the caregivers in my support group, where because they didn't understand, law enforcement didn't react well to the situation.
It can escalate it. It's like those reports we hear about the mentally ill. You know, they just need to know what's going on there, because a mentally ill person or someone with dementia is not going to act rational. And if you are thinking they're rational, you're going to act inappropriately.
Exactly.
For example, you know, I have a gas station, and there was a time about a year ago that this guy was looking in. One of my employees was emptying his car. It had some stuff in it. And so it was open, and he was inside. Then he'd come outside for, you know, about a minute later. And while he was inside, this guy was, you know, going in his car and going through his glove compartment and saw some money, put some money in his pocket. And my employee, when he came out, like, freaked out. What are you doing in my car? You know, where's the money that was here? You know, just, and he was very disoriented. And being a caregiver myself, and the caregiver's caregiver, I immediately suspected that he was dementia ridden or Alzheimer's. And he had driven in the station. So here we got a guy who's disoriented and he's driving. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I interviewed him a little bit, and he's going to his son's house in San Diego, and he's coming from San Francisco. And I'm amazed he made it that far, because we're kind of like in L.A. Mm-hmm. And I called the sheriff to have him, you know, check it out. But he wasn't going to have it. He drove away before the sheriff got there. So yeah, and I've always believed that kids in school should get training on how to be a caregiver, because, you know, it's something that'll stay in their mind. You know, it's like home ec, right? In case, God forbid, they have to cook for themselves, find themselves a bachelor for 10 years, at least they're not going to starve. They know how to make a grilled cheese sandwich, for gosh sakes. And something similar for caregiving, because most people are thrust into it and they don't know a thing about it. At least they can go to that corner of their brain and say, wait, I learned about this, and it'll be better than nothing. So that's awesome what you're doing.
And not only that, a lot of times grandparents relate well to grandchildren. And somebody with dementia, they may even see the grandchild as their child.
Their child, right.
But grandchildren and grandparents, they have very special relationships, and that's one of the things that I break out when I talk to the kids in high school. Your mom and dad may have a problem that, you know, the person with dementia isn't relating to them because they don't recognize them, but they may very well recognize you in that loving relationship that you have.
Yeah, I remember reading in an Alzheimer's book one time that it isn't that. Because the kids get so upset that they aren't recognized anymore. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they let it upset them more than they should, because it's not about them. You know, it's about their parents. And this person explained it this way. They says it's not that they don't know you anymore. It's just that they don't recognize you anymore, because their brain is going back and back. Okay. And maybe they see you now as a 15-year-old, and you're, you know, 65, and you don't look like you're 15 anymore. And she proved it, because on the other side of the door, you know, she was knocking on the door and says, "Let me in, I'm so-and-so." And so she recognized the voice and let them in. But as soon as she saw, she says, "Well, who are you? You're not so-and-so, you know, you're an old man." And once the visual thing came in, you know, sometimes a 15-year-old will still sound the same. So yeah, it's pretty amazing.
I've talked to my children about this, and what I've told them is, I may not recognize you as you are now, but I still love you as much as I ever did. And I may very well have gone back in time when we were a young person. So if I look at you and I say, "Who are you?" I hope you'll smile, tell me your name, and tell me about your mother. And my daughter said to me, well, that'll never happen to you, but I'll share this information with other people. Well, that's
and
a
can
nice
you
thought.
Imagine how valuable that information is, maybe in a senior year in college to teenagers? First of all, I think they'd be very interested in it because all of a sudden, you know, you're talking about something that they never heard of, never considered, and they hope would never happen to them. But it's going to be filed away.
Right.
And if and when that day ever happens, they're going to be a little more prepared than if, you know, they're just jumping into the lake or into the ocean with no life preserver.
I have to tell you, when Mike and I just stepped up and said, we want to bring your dad to live with us when that situation arose, we said, well, we know it's going to be difficult, but he's going to be so much better in our care. Having no idea what we were getting into, how long it was going to last, how difficult it was going to become, which is why I now dedicate what I do, prepare to care, especially when Alzheimer's organization is now telling us mm-hmm. 1 in 3 seniors will die with some form of dementia and the numbers are increasing every day. Chances are your family is going to deal with this on some level.
Yeah. I have an employee who had to leave because his father came down with dementia. And it wasn't even, you know, he didn't have a relationship with his father. I mean, he was a terrible father most of his life. And, you know, he wasn't present. But yet he, you know, his heart went out to this man who later in life, you know, had a relationship with. And so he lives in this tiny little apartment with his 4 kids and his wife. And he says, you know, I'm thinking about doing this. And I kind of told him, you know, the cost is going to be great. And it's not only a cost on you, it'll be a cost on your children, a cost on your wife.
Well, I often tell people not everybody can do this and not everybody should do this. And most often, because we don't know what we're getting into, people assume that because you love a person and you have their best interests at heart that you can do this. And I definitely believe that we all need to learn as much as we can going forward because the situation changes moment by moment, not alone day by day, moment by moment.
You know, I question motives too. Are there motives? I mean, because he has other siblings and, you know, they could have done something, but, you know, why him? Are there motives? Are there right motives and wrong motives to care for your parent who has dementia? Can you think of any wrong motives?
Well, sometimes people get into it because they want to be the one that's closest to the person that has the estate. I hesitate to say that, but that's true sometimes. And there are people who very much want to be in control, and trying to be the one in control when you're dealing with somebody with dementia is not a good mix. So it could even be that personality difference that doesn't make it right.
What if this person doesn't have anything, you know, and so it's obviously not the money thing. Do you think the relationship they never had with his father, perhaps? He wants to be,
sometimes.
You know, maybe he craved that attention as a young person and somehow his mind is saying, well, here's a way I can get it. Or, you know, I don't know what goes on in a person's mind.
Is it possible that he treated his father badly at one point and he's looking to make... make amends.
Sure. They'll tell him why people do what they do. But I always try to look at my motives because I think it's more important why we do what we do than what we do what we do. I mean, I don't know if that makes sense, but
that's a good point.
I've been living my life because I think it's possible to do the right thing for the wrong motive.
Absolutely.
And I don't think that's good.
Absolutely. I happen to come from a long line of family caregivers going back generations. It just seemed maybe it was because of poverty or maybe it was just because of the way that some families just kind of pull together. But whenever there's been somebody in need for whatever reason, somebody, at least one person in the family has stepped up, and sometimes several. I had an older sister who died suddenly with a four-year-old, and the rest of the siblings and cousins were all saying, we'll take the four-year-old. In my case, it's kind of, we were raised with the belief that family takes care of family, but I also know that not everybody in the family can do this. I've had a cousin who stepped up to take care of her mom and then said, I didn't sign up for this. I had no idea. But her daughter is a natural caregiver, so she stepped in to help. So we see both sides of it in the family. Fortunately, with my father-in-law, it worked for us. But we had, you know, I was able to leave my job without, you know, putting us financially in a terrible position. And my husband could take care of that while I took care of his dad. But I always am very clear, if this isn't for you, if you don't feel that you should do this, then you shouldn't be doing it, because it's all consuming once you're in there. If you can't be there 24/7 day after day, maybe you can be the one that does the taxes, or you're the one that takes care of the yard, or you're the one that deals with the doctors. You don't have to be in there 24/7 to contribute to the caregiving of somebody in your family.
Even if they, like your father-in-law lived with you, but I don't know, did you have your husband's siblings that were able to help in other ways?
Mike has one brother who completely stepped back and didn't even want to hear about what was going on. Mm-hmm. And my father-in-law had one brother who pretty much did the same thing. He said it was too hard for him to see his brother like that and stayed away as much as possible. So in our situation, it was pretty much us. Mm-hmm. But we knew that going in. And that's one of the things that I learned. You don't have to be there in the moment.
Right.
There are other ways that you can help. Bring a meal now and then. That'll help. Exactly.
Bobby, do you find that the caregiving generally falls to the daughter rather than to a son or a brother or other male member of the family?
I think it does. It's certainly not exclusively, because I do hear from a lot of male caregivers, and I have some in my caregiver support group that are doing that, spouses and sons. Mm-hmm. But generally it is women more often than men. And I also think that the male caregivers have different challenges. Mm-hmm. In that it's in their nature to fix things, and when they can't fix it, it's very frustrating. It makes it difficult. But certainly there are millions of male caregivers and teen caregivers, and just about every demographic has caregivers in, but it's primarily women, I think, and it's part of our nurturing
nature.
It's what we do.
So what other things do you talk about besides prepare to care?
Depending on the group that I'm speaking to, you know, there's some of the things that are pretty much universal to caregivers, caregiver guilt. I was at a conference and they started talking about caregiver guilt and what you feel guilty about. And one person talked about playing the piano, which is something that they always did together, and now the other person can't play anymore. And in the meantime, I'm sitting in the back room with my hand waving frantically saying, that is nothing compared to what I felt guilty about. I felt guilty about losing my temper. I felt guilty about wishing I had my life back. So I like to get up in front of people and tell them, you know, how desperate you can feel when you're doing this, and how to work through that. Preparing for the holidays, you know, and things like practical situation. What to do when the person caregiver, all they ever say is no. How do you deal with that? And how to get more people to help. I wrote an article called Why Caregivers Ignore All That Great Advice About Taking Care of Themselves First. And
why do they?
I think it puts an extra burden on them. You know, so many of those tips are well-intentioned, and what they're asking for is true, which is, you know, exercise, make sure you eat right, get enough rest. But if we're going to tell caregivers that, we have to give them an opportunity to do those things. If you want me to get some rest, come over and spend some time with the person in care so I can take a nap if I need to, or just spend a few minutes, you know, breathing. Without having to worry about what you're up to. So I'm a big proponent of when somebody says, let me know if you need help, giving them something to do almost immediately.
Yeah.
I am too. I always tell people to be ready with what you need if somebody makes an offer. That
have a list.
Have a list and be... make it so that it's not just an empty offer, because if they're asking, you've got to take advantage of it right away, or they may just disappear.
And they may assume
strike
that
the
you're...
iron while it's hot.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
If you don't give them something to do, one, they don't know how they can help you, and two, they're going to assume that you're okay on your own, and you're not.
And they won't ask again.
That's right.
And sometimes people do want to be the only ones that are taking care. It's very hard for them to relinquish their control.
That's their claim to fame, you know?
Exactly.
And they don't want to share it. They don't want to share the light.
Well, I had so moments.
They'd rather be a martyr and rather complain about how no help, you know, and the siblings don't do anything and da, 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 da. And my mother-in-law is like that. She just gets so much joy out of complaining how nobody helps her. And I almost don't want to take that away from her, because she'd have nothing to talk about.
And there's also, I think, a feeling when you're in it and you have such a schedule for various medications and, you know, know what to expect at certain times of day, you get a little fearful of walking away and letting somebody else mess it up for you.
Sure.
I know I had moments like that where my husband was saying, why don't you just go see a movie or something? And I would go and I would worry about what was going on at home. And maybe
how much can he mess up in 2 hours? Come on.
But there was still that feeling. And when I walked in and said, well, did he have his 2 o'clock meds? Well, he was asleep. So no. And it's now 5 o'clock and he's missed that. And of course, it didn't change anything in the long run. But in that moment, I was like, I can't even leave the house to, you know, for an hour.
Of course,
so
you left him instructions to get those 2 o'clock meds. Right. Right.
Of course. But
say what to do in case he was sleeping.
You know, those kind of things happen. You get so involved in it, you almost believe that nobody can do it as well as you.
Exactly. And
men are so one-dimensional thinking, you've got to, like, take an extra step. If it was a woman, she probably would have done it. I've figured it out.
Thanks, Dave.
No problem. Just talking from experience. So what else should we talk about? I'm out of questions, so I'm throwing the ball in your court. Adrian, you got anything?
Yeah, well, so I've been taking too much of the time, Adrian. I'd love to hear more from you.
No, I did not know that you were so focused on just dementia and Alzheimer's and elder care. Are you at all involved with
other things?
Other ailments?
Oh, absolutely. Any long-term care, you know, where caregivers are involved on a day-to-day basis for an extended period of time, are people that I hear from and people that I love to work with and people that I love to support. The ALS came up recently.
Right.
We're doing an ALS walk on the 3rd. So happens my father-in-law's brother now has ALS, which drew us into that. But, you know, even people who are caring for children with developmental issues or any kind of illness where caregivers need support, I'm there for them.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I wanted to clarify that, because I thought you did, you know, that it was more expansive. So you,
yes, and I appreciate
you are.
And I appreciate.
I want to talk about your previous book, and you're writing a new book, right?
Yes.
So let's take a quick break, and we'll talk about that. We've got about 8 more minutes to go, and we'll finish up that way. How's that?
That'll work.
Anytime we suffer loss, we grieve. And a lot of people don't realize what even the grief process is. But it could be 5 to 7 steps, ranging from denial, I don't believe this is happening, anger, oh my gosh, I'm so upset this is happening, to a form of bargaining, how can I get out of this, to depression, which is a very serious thing because that often leads to suicide. And then finally, after you realize you have no more control over your situation and you're totally okay with the new normal that it brings, that wonderful, wonderful place called acceptance.
Being a caregiver takes a special person with passion and compassion. But even you can become a little burned out from time to time. The Caregiver's Caregiver Radio Show was developed to help you overcome obstacles, adversity, and burnout, as well as just having a place to rest, relax, and recharge your batteries. We've all been there, and you're not alone. Now, you can take the Caregiver's Caregiver with you. Get the top 25 radio shows in convenient form that plugs right into your USB car stereo or computer. Learn the techniques, tips, and encouragement we all need to better handle the day-to-day challenges. For around $1 per show, just $29.77, get the credit card-sized USB card to have with you anytime you need a caregiver's pick-me-up. Just go to DaveTheCaregiversCaregiver.com and order yours today. Go to DaveTheCaregiversCaregiver.com now. Consider it an investment in you, and ultimately, an investment in them.
And we're back with Adrian Gruberg and Bobby Carducci. So let's talk about your books, Bobby.
Okay. the first one, Confessions of an Imperfect Caregiver, I wrote it so it reads like a novel, but every single word is true. And I wrote it because, first of all, I've been writing since I was 8 years old. And in the process of taking care of Dad, I heard from a number of caregivers who said, why doesn't somebody write a book that tells what it's really like? And I thought, well, I can do that. And I started writing it while he was still with us. And then, of course, his care took over and there just wasn't time to do it. And so I put it aside. And after he had passed away and he'd been gone a few months, I picked it up and started writing again and found that I was reliving it to such a degree that it was just too much to handle. So I set it aside again. Wow. And probably about a year after that, I kept thinking, this book needs to be written. So I warned my husband. I said, I'm going to write this book, and I'm going to be reliving it, and it's going to be emotional, and be prepared. And so I did write it, and I'm really, really proud of it. And, you know, it's been called brutally honest, and caregivers appreciate that honesty. In fact, I had to warn my husband. There are I actually asked his permission to put in some situations where he was not at his best, as I had done for myself. And he said, absolutely. He allowed me to do that. And those are some of the favorite parts in the book where, you know, you admit how human you are. I am very, very proud of that book. And I am now working on one called If It Happens to Me, what a caregiver wants her family members to know, which will encompass a lot of things that I've learned since I was a caregiver, by going to these caregiver conferences and talking to specialists in this area about how to deal with specific situations, like when my daughters may hear me say, who are you? or what, how to deal with a person who refuses to bathe, and, you know, situations like that. And I mentioned it at a writer's conference I attended recently, to someone who specializes in nonfiction. And I said, I think this book will probably sell more at caregiver events and things like that than in the bookstores. And he said, don't necessarily think that's true, Bobby, which indicates to me that this issue is getting so big that more and more people are interested in it. So it's kind of told me I need to get my fanny in the chair more often than I've been doing and get this book done.
What, now the other one, Brutally Honest, what's the subtitle on that one?
Oh, no. The Confessions of an
Saying you had to be brutally honest.
Yes, and okay. People have called it that. But the second book is If It Happens to Me, What a Caregiver Wants Her Family to Know. So it'll be a combination of probably essays along with tips on how to deal with these particular situations.
Yeah. That's a good title too, Brutally Honest.
Yeah.
A Caregiver's Confession. I can see it now.
Yeah, now we've inspired you. What's your next book?
if it happens to me, do you talk about taking away your own car keys?
I will include that. And the fact is, as somebody who has been living with this for as long as I have, and, you know, as you people have as well, there are moments when I get a little scared, you know, when I can't remember a word or is this the first sign?
Right.
I got an email with a picture of one of my granddaughters in it, and I sat there and I could not remember her name. And I'm thinking it's not Mallory. It's not Shelley. I said to my husband, you need to keep an eye on me. I said, I couldn't remember Rachel's name. He said, Bobby, you forgot when you were raising the kids, you half the time you couldn't remember their names either. So I felt a little better in the moment, but that's the kind of thing that I'm watching for now.
Yeah.
I do that too. And I answered an ad on Facebook about 3 years ago that said, if you're worried that you're getting Alzheimer's or dementia, you know, come and sign up for this free test, free clinical study on. So I signed up and I've been taking tests every 6 months, and then they compare the scores, you know, and it's the test that I told you about. You know, they have you count backwards from in terms of sevens, and they tell you stories and you have to repeat them, and then they give you a bunch of objects and you have to, you know, and then they'll come back and then they'll give you a second set of objects, then they'll go back to the first set, and, you know, they test you in all these different areas. And so I'm right up there on the borderline. I haven't crossed the threshold yet, but I'm not getting worse. And in fact, my last one, I got slightly better because I've been doing things like going back to the piano and learning new songs and stuff like that. And, you know, they say jigsaw puzzles are good. So there's things you can do to slow it down. Now, let's face it, some people are just naturally dingy and airheadish. You know, I think of Edith Bunker and Gracie Allen and Rose on the Golden Girls. I mean, you know, they're always going to be like that. But hopefully that doesn't develop into something else. And, you know, my kids all worry about me. They say, oh, you know, what's he going to be like in 20 years? And I just change my diaper and put me in that long care plan in Malibu where I can just look at the ocean. And he says, but you wouldn't even know it's the ocean. We'll save money and we'll put you in Pacoima. If you don't know where Pacoima is, you don't want to go there.
Well, I hear stories like that too from my kids. And one of the things that I do tell people is choose who you want your caregiver to be, because not all of our children are gifted in the same way.
Yep, that's true. Well, listen, I can't believe how fast the time has flown. So tell us how we can get a hold of you, Bobby.
You can go to my website, which is bobbycarducci.com. And also theimperfectcaregiver.com is my blog. And soon I will be on YouTube.
Really? Not on YouTube yet, huh?
Not yet, but my publicist is saying you need to be there.
Yeah.
Well, good. I'm already there, so I'm one step ahead of you.
There you are, and I'm glad of it, and thoroughly enjoyed talking to both of you today.
Oh, it was our pleasure. Thank you so much. And Adrian, how do we get a hold of you?
I will be on YouTube eventually.
I'll show you how to do
right
it.
Now, it's easy. Right now, it's Adrienne, Adrienne, at thecaregiverspace.org. And the website's thecaregiverspace.org. And on Facebook, it's The Caregiver Space.
Awesome. And again, a reminder, all our live shows, including this one, become recorded podcasts for our website. And she talks all about this new model of caregiver referral service. And it was a great interview, wasn't it, Adrian?
It was. And she was a terrific spokesperson. Yeah.
Yes. So while you're at my website, by the way, caregiverscaregiver.com, or if you have to remember something easier, davethecaregiver.com, you'll see a short quiz that says, are you a candidate for burnout? Just for taking that quiz, I'm going to send you my first book absolutely free at $10 value. Still getting rave reviews, My Wife's Amazing Story. Bobby and Adrian, thank you again for coming on, and we will see you next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining Dave, the Caregiver's Caregiver Radio Show. Make sure you tune in every Wednesday at noon Pacific Time and anytime afterwards on podcast to catch more of Dave and his tips to caregivers on avoiding burnout and surviving the grief process right here on the Worldwide Block Talk Radio Network. Goodbye.